You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, with a deadly attack in downtown Bangkok, is Thailand on the verge of more political violence? I'll discuss that with my special guests, Daniela Pellet from the Institute for War and Peace Reporting and Alessio Patilano from the Department of War Studies at King's College London. Then, in the face of mounting security threats from Russia, NATO members on the alliance's eastern flank are lobbying for permanent bases. So will that happen? Not if Germany has anything to do with it. We'll look at the pros and cons. And later in the programme, it's been called a real-life version of Spy versus Spy. We'll explore how Iran and America's naval forces are coming uncomfortably close on the high seas. All those stories and more besides, starting right now on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. So welcome to today's programme. My guests today are Daniela Pellet, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Alessio Patilano, senior lecturer from the Department of War Studies at King's College London. Welcome both to the programme. Great to have you with us, as always. Let's begin today's discussion in Bangkok, where at least 20 people have died following Monday's bomb explosion near a popular shrine in the heart of the city's commercial and tourist district. Thai police are following a number of leads and are searching for a male suspect captured on CCTV. No groups claimed responsibility for the attack as yet. Besides the dead, 120 others were injured in the blast. The attack raises questions about the country's turbulent history of political violence. And Alessio, perhaps we'll start with you. Let's look at that history. It is rather long and checkered, including relatively recently, of course. What could this incident represent? Is it a return to the worst of the bad old days, potentially?
Well, I think days are clear difference between what happened yesterday and past sort of expressions of violence, of armed violence in Thailand. The blast was much bigger. The type of materials was more sophisticated than usual, especially in the southern part of Thailand. We're accustomed to sort of regular outbursts of that kind of confrontation, but this was somewhat different. And I think part of it has to do with the fact that Thailand has been run by a military junta for quite some time now, and the reforms there they put in place are not really reforms, really. They are consolidating their power. The promise of elections has been sort of pushed back a number of times. The constitutional reforms have been discussed. They seem to head towards a direction that is all but democratic. Therefore, this begs the question as to whether there is a connection between this type of different event and a certain increase in the speed of the sort of militarization of politics in Thailand, which has always been the case, but it seems now to be reaching a new level. So is this a response from people that are sick and tired of sort of protesting their way and they want to sort of go forward through different means?
And Daniela, obviously it's rather early to speculate in terms of cause and effect. As we mentioned, we're yet to see anybody claiming responsibility. But it is interesting perhaps to speculate about what the response from the military junta could be. As Alessio points out, they have a checkered record, and we do often see events of this nature being used as a pretext to introduce, you know, draconian legislation to further sort of tighten grip. Do you fear that we might see that happen?
I think that's extremely plausible. I mean, this is a pattern you see anywhere in the world where you have a military regime or any kind of non-democratic regime. The threat of terror, whether real or imagined, is used to shrink the space for civil liberties. I mean, as you said, the charter and the elections have been delayed over and over again. I understand that the earliest they might take place now is 2017. Mm-hmm. So certainly this is an opportunity for the junta to do that. What might happen also, we might have to accept the fact that this the reasons or the people behind this bombing may never be solved. I mean, nearly 10 years ago was the previous most deadly bomb attack, and no one knows who was responsible for that. I mean, the speculation has been fierce and immense. It doesn't seem to be the separatist rebels in the south. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem, I mean, it could be the the Red Shirts, the anti-hunter groups, but it seems a bit of a strange method to target a religious shrine, rather alienating. And if it is an international Islamist terror group, the fact that no one has claimed responsibility kind of makes that look a bit awkward as well.
Alessia, do you think that it is obviously, you know, it's difficult looking at these sorts of instances before we have claims of responsibility and whilst the dust is almost literally still continuing to settle, but it's important to, I guess, remember some of the, you know, the factionalism, the political divides that exist within the country, as well as those which are along, you know, religious lines or, you know, military against public lines. It's quite a fractured picture.
It is quite a fractured picture. I think what is interesting is that the place that was chosen is a religious place, of course, but at the same time, it's also very much of a tourist attraction. It's in the middle of a commuting area. There's lots of tourists all the time. And tourism is one of the bedrocks of Thailand's economy. So it seems to me that one of the pieces of this puzzle that really is difficult to locate is why this place, why now? And unless you connect that sort of political military dimension to the fact that tourism is the main backbone that allows these regime to carry on like that, it kind of points a certain direction, if you want. Then who actually was? God knows. I mean, at the moment, there's so many variables that have to be figured out, because it could be an internal thing, it could be religious, it could be also aimed at tourism, you know, the tourists in there. What kind of signal is, we don't know, because it's new and in this format has not appeared before and nobody has claimed it. So, you know, you got both, if you want, the evidence and the perpetrator that are completely unknown in a context that is unfamiliar. So it's relatively difficult. Everything would be sort of a bit of a guesswork at the moment, really.
Daniel, it was interesting to look at General Pryor's reaction. He gave quite a sort of emotional press conference where he talked about this being the most sort of damaging and devastating attack, you know, ever in Thailand. Again, do you think that's were you sort of intrigued by that response? Would we perhaps have been expecting something more, I don't know, sort of aggressive, outspoken, talking about catching the perpetrators? Or do you think that this is a bit of, you know, there is a PR game also being played here? It is important about the presentation, even when it comes down to how the general at the heart of this junta, you know, reacts to this attack.
Well, they were disarmingly honest, saying they had no prior intelligence, they had no idea, and a bit of emotion being shown by the head of a military junta never did anyone any harm. I mean, as you said, the number one thing here is tourism. What impact this will have on tourism. It's already affected the currency. Off the cuff, I can't see it having a major effect on tourism. Something like Tunisia, which was a much more targeted and sort of horrific attack in a country which is already fairly unstable, I think, you know, dealt the death blow to tourism there. But Hong Kong, Hong Kong is the only country that's told people not to travel there. I think other European countries, America, have asked for caution. But I don't think if this incident is isolated, I don't think that's going to have a major impact on tourism. And that really is where the major impact of this bomb blast would be felt.
And it's interesting, Alessia, isn't it, to look back to those demonstrations, even when there was a sort of state of martial law going back over the last couple of years or so, tourism was fairly robust. Even during those periods, it was quite an extraordinary picture. Those who were in Bangkok would tell you, you would see, you know, lockdowns happening, you know, military in the streets. And then in these little busy tourist areas, people carrying on almost unaffected.
Absolutely. I think that's, sadly, that's one of the advantages of having a very strong military that has its main sort of function policing its own country. I mean, we should not forget that Thailand has seen a number of coups over the past 40, 50 years. I mean, the history of Thailand is intertwined with, you know, ways of doing a coup, a military coup of sorts. So in that respect, I think it suggests something. It says something in terms of also that this might very well be the exception out of what is an otherwise very tightly controlled space, which is also possibly one of the emotional elements. Like, how is that possible? Because we think we are in control of everything as it unfolds in front of our eyes. And there is also an element of that, interestingly enough. I had Thai students in the past, and it's always very interesting to see how they see the history of their own country, the political history of their own country, as intrinsically connected to this powerful role that the military has in politics. It's some sort of a negation of the Huntingtonian model, if you want, the soldier and the state, the separation of power. When it comes to Thailand, that's simply not the case. And I suppose part of the explanation why you can have a politically tense country like Thailand with an economy based on tourism that keeps going, perhaps the answer is over that.
Just briefly on that, Alessio, some people have said today, maybe a little cynically, look, well, you know, you had essentially an almost non-violent coup before, but the violence is always there somewhere. It will bubble up in one way, whether that's in the form of resistance or whatever. Is that a bit of a simplistic reading, or do you think there's an element of truth to that?
No, I think there is a genuine element of truth in that, because there's just so much control the eunuchs exert. And, you know, this goes back to a fundamental question. What is the social contract that ties people in any given state with their own institutions? And there must be some sort of balance. And when the balance is broken, when you try to push the boundaries of balance too much, you will have reactions. Now, these reactions might be pacifist, might be about protest, but if people are tired or under different type of pressure, they might go out and search for different type of answers that might be all the more violent.
Let's move on. Let's move to Europe, where NATO's members on the alliance's eastern flank are hoping to join together to pressure NATO to put permanent military bases in the region. A summit will be held to discuss the plans in November. This is nothing new for Poland, which has lobbied for permanent bases for quite some time. Germany, however, is opposed to such an idea. Daniele, what's your reading of this? What is it easy to characterise the broad appetite for this sort of change amongst NATO members? Is it very much, you know, two camps and they're at polar opposites?
I don't know if it's so extreme, but this latest development has very much been led by the new Polish president, who has something of a point to make. I mean, the Polish president isn't terribly powerful, but he's the commander of the armed forces and he's a sort of foreign policy representative. And he's just been signed into office, and he's launching it with a tour of Europe and America and very much making this point. I mean, perhaps some people in the West were a little surprised by Russian intransigence a couple of years ago, but the Poles have always seen them as an existential threat. I mean, and the Poles are have got a very well-funded, well-resourced, well-equipped army, not you know, in part in due to this. So I think this is very much now a Polish initiative, and the Baltic states are very happy to go along.
Alessio, let me ask you then about the Russian response, because Russia would clearly, or one imagines, as they have before, say, well, look, this is a threat to us if this should happen. But Poland must be within their rights, given what's happened in Ukraine, to moot this point, this sort of action.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more. I think there is an element there. You know, before starting the game of the chicken and the egg, which one came first and who started what, I think it is important to remind ourselves that just a few days back, Putin, as was celebrating the Russian Navy Day, announced a new maritime doctrine, the Maritime Doctrine 2015, which is beautiful. I mean, for a kid like myself who grew up in the 80s with the Hunt for Red October, it's like, yeah, you know, the Hunt for Red October is coming back sometime in the near future. But if you shake off the euphoria of the days when you were a kid, I mean, this is all rather concerning altogether. I mean, there have been military operations that led to the annexation of Crimea, which is internationally illegal. You got movement in eastern Ukraine. Fighting in eastern Ukraine was very serious, as we haven't seen for a while. I think whilst it certainly is understandable, and I completely agree with the point about the president in Poland being the sort of in the driving seat for these calls, but there is a legitimate concern there. I mean, the eastern frontiers that concern NATO as one of its primary areas of operations are in dispute. And at the moment, there have been military activities that clearly showed that the situation is not as quiet. It's not all quiet on the Western Front, as it were. And so that brings about an important question. I certainly understand why Angela Merkel might feel as if you don't want to sort of escalate things with Russians, but at the same time, where do you draw the line? Have we made clear what are the red lines that shouldn't be crossed? And I'm not sure that the Russians, given also what Putin keeps doing, including this latest maritime doctrine, are actually thinking that anybody is serious this side of the fence about what they're doing this in Europe.
Well, Daniela, I wonder then, does this kind of bring us back to the core of really what NATO is for? Because we're talking, I guess, about Poland saying this is about the protection of NATO members, and if not about that, what's the point almost?
Well, we've had similar discussions about the European Union, about all supranational bodies, where the remit is quite large and they don't always have a unifying interest. I mean, Germany does not have the same interest in this as some of the Baltic states. I mean, the European Union doesn't have the same the whole of the spread of the European doesn't have the same interests. What I think the West is, frankly, still a bit scared of Russia and not pushing it too far. I mean, we've been skirting around each other, not with sort of NATO advancing, but holding exercises here, putting troops there, trying to send a message, but not go too far. The thing is though, the Russians have carried out many, many more of these military exercises than NATO. So even in this sort of brinksmanship, they are being much bolder, making their point much more strongly. And this doesn't soothe the fears of anyone in the Baltic states.
So, Alessia, where do you think that's going to leave us then? Because if you continue this sort of, well, tit for tat, you know, it's like mutual suggestions of existential threat, do you inevitably get to the point where there's an unsustainable and unpredictable build-up, whether it's of weapons, of pressure, political and otherwise? Is that necessarily what's going to happen, do you think?
I don't think that is what necessarily is going to happen. Look, Russia, Soviet Union, and before Russia, has been part of the political game, knowing the rules of the game in Europe and in the wider sort of international politics for donkey's age. They're not new to this game. They know exactly what the rules are. They're trying to play around the boundaries of those rules. We kind of stop thinking about sort of reminding ourselves that rules are there. There are red lines and you can play with that. That doesn't mean that automatically you're heading towards escalation. Quite the contrary. You're just measuring up to the challenge that has been presented before you. And I think that is really one of the bigger questions that for me when I read this type of coverage brings about is the question of leadership that in Europe at the political level has been relatively lacking for quite some time. Taking what would be considered a bold move, which it isn't really, is restating position, whether it is a more robust exercise like the latest one that NATO brought about closer to the sort of boundary areas of the alliance, or having bases for prepositioning forces. This is not going to bring the world to an end. Putin knows that. The Russians know that because they know this game. So it's a question of testing the willingness of the alliance and the members within it.
More lobbying, one imagines, from Warsaw towards NATO, and lobbying effort of a different kind, this time from Barack Obama to Democratic members of Congress that we want to talk about next. He's trying to convince them to support his nuclear deal. Obama's personally calling members of Congress with appeals to support his deal, which faces a vote next month. It's quite interesting, Daniel, to look at this in the context of some other you know, the broad brush diplomatic niceties between Washington and Tehran. They seem to be getting on fairly famously at the negotiating table. But maybe the militaries haven't seen the memo. Some interesting reports today about the naval forces kind of spying on one another, this sort of spy versus spy. Perhaps we shouldn't be surprised to see that, even given these moves in Washington and Tehran. Do you think, I don't know, what's your response when you read these pieces or see things about this sort of, I don't know what you'd call it, espionage type effort?
Well, what I found rather delightful was that the commander of the Iranian Navy told the state news agency that he just laughed at US threats, which sounded like something out of a Monty Python film to me. No, of course it's to be expected. I mean, I'd be very surprised if they weren't doing this, sort of sailing into each other's waters and buzzing each other and sort of videoing each other. What surprises me more about this whole is the lobbying, and I've been puzzling over it, and I haven't really come to a conclusion that, you know, a quarter of Democrats in Congress would need to abandon Obama to derail this deal. It's extremely unlikely, and yet both sides, for and against, are devoting enormous resources in lobbying for their side of the argument. Mm. And I'm wondering why, when it's the deal is kind of apparently so done, and perhaps it's due to internal and domestic political reasons, but they really have been using the big guns, trying the faith groups, trying lobby influence. You know, when a senior Republican or Democrat comes out against the bill, it's seen as an enormous deal. But really, it looks like it's going to happen.
Alessio, what do you make of that? I mean, it is an interesting point that Daniela raises there. Given that this looked a done deal, it was presented with an air of finality when it was agreed, what, just last month. But as Daniela says, the big guns are being wheeled out by both sides. Are they playing domestic politics?
Well, I think what's interesting, one of the articles about Obama's sort of personally lobbying, is that there seems to be a tension that was always on the background of the negotiations, and that is between Israel and the United States. And this now tension has been played out in American domestic politics, where pro-Israel groups have a tremendous lobbying power, and they're now deploying this, making no excuse for the fact that they just don't like this deal, they don't want to see it through. So I can imagine, by reading what the New York Times was suggesting, that the Israeli authorities in Washington D.C. are calling upon all sorts of people and groups, and I can imagine that they can be a very powerful group if they want or they don't want something to happen, which would naturally bring about a bit of a chill along the president's spine, and see therefore him mobilizing his own phone calls and his own people to reach out to all Democrats in order to keep the line hold.
So perhaps we shouldn't be too surprised about that occurrence. What though, Alessio? What do you make of the maritime detail with these? Yeah, as Daniela says, this sort of nose tweaking that's going on, particularly in the Arabian Sea. The sides mutually filming one another on these sorties. Is that just par for the course? The detail seems it's almost comical. Except rather too serious to be funny, I guess.
Well, it is, and this is the reality. This is the new normal in maritime affairs. I mean, one of the biggest phenomena of the past, I would say, certainly. I mean, it's always been the case, but certainly the past 4 or 5 years in the maritime domain has been that you have a strong increase in the number of actors operating in the waters, and actors that have been empowered by states to operate and to sort of take advantage of state rights generated by UNCLOS, whether it is within home waters or in the EEZ. We've seen this in for months we've been talking about South China Sea or East China Sea, where China is sort of doing this in the Arabian Gulf. Now that's Iran. Guess what? It's not just in the South China Sea that these things happen. They do happen everywhere. And I think what's interesting, and it's reported in the article, is how you have to become, in order to play a game that has become much more complicated because you've got more actors, and these actors report back to government that can spin the story in different ways, then you have to start doing all sorts of possible things to gain the evidence that will eventually support your case more. If anything, towards the broader public. Hence, video recording anything that is happening, because 5 minutes after something has happened, if you think that the other guy is going to have the upper hand, you always have the YouTube option that is going to save your day. We've seen these happening pretty much in other places, and I'm not surprising, but that is really one of the interesting things that these tell us. It's not just a very dangerous game, one where you've got guns pointed at a helicopter and you have to be very careful about what you do in order to prevent escalation. It's also once all the dust is settled, who's going to see where they're going to see it and how people are going to respond.
The old story about whoever gets to write those little bits of history, I guess. More international intrigue next. I wanted to ask you both about the revelations this week regarding American domestic spying in this case. Another New York Times investigation uncovered telecom giant AT&T assisting the National Security Agency, the NSA, with wiretapping internet communications at the UN headquarters in New York City. The UN said it's deciding how best to respond to the allegations. Daniela, I'll come to you next. Should we be surprised, again, talking about obvious snooping occurring, any degree of surprise with this news?
very little as far as the UN are concerned, but certainly it's a public relations disaster for AT&T. They've been trying to row back and saying we only cooperate if someone is about to die. Well, actually, the reality seems that they were a little bit more forthcoming than that. I mean, we're talking about massive amounts of data, and this is really the era of mass data of such enormous quantities that a layperson really couldn't comprehend. It's not a question of an old-fashioned spy wiretap listening to what someone says. I mean, it's on an industrial scale. We don't know whether they're still doing it. I mean, the last available data was from 2 years ago. It's important that these things are highlighted because other enormous groups like Google, Apple, Facebook seem to be less acquiescent to requests by NSA and other bodies, and that's that's a good thing. Now, whether it's because it doesn't play well with the public, or because it's some belief in freedom of speech and privacy,
Come down to dollars and cents, I suspect, but we'll never know for sure. Alessio, what do you make of this? Because some people, I guess, would say, well, hang on a minute, the United Nations must be a veritable den of spies. You have so many member states, the welcome and rather unwelcome within the international community amongst them. Surely this is, once again, just par for the course, exactly what we should expect.
That is true, but I suppose here the point is slightly different, in that it's not everybody spying in everybody else, on everybody else, which would be kind of fairly okay. Frankly, it would be also fun. I mean, it probably is in the job description these days. Come join the UN, learn how to talk diplomatically, eat well, and spy on other people. I mean, hello, who wouldn't want to do it? However, here we're talking about something slightly different. This is a telecommunication company that belongs to one actor that is part of the UN, that is providing access to one organization that belongs to one state actor, access to information about everybody else. Now, that's pretty unfair, if you ask me. And this is one of those things that the UN should not be sort of put at the center of, precisely because it creates an unfair system, whereas the UN theoretically is designed to be an organization where fairness is the ultimate rule.
Hollow laugh here.
true. But you see, there's a difference between the principle and the practicalities of things. And I think that these type of events, as you say, when you report this, why it is important, because it reminds us of the difference between the sacrosanct and important elements connected to notions of this principle enshrine, and how they are twisted and stretched to the point of breaking up when they are implemented in practice. And that is really what the story is about for me.
Let's finish the show by talking about two women in the US who've made history by becoming the first female soldiers to pass the Army's notoriously testing Ranger course. US Army Rangers are some of the most well-trained soldiers in the world. We've got some details, what these grueling tests, 49 push-ups, sit-ups, a 5-mile run in 40 minutes, chin-up swimming, land navigation, a 12-mile foot march, and so it goes. Daniela, we'll start with you. What do you make of this story? You must be delighted to see female representatives in the US Rangers at last, surely.
The sisters. I can't even begin to describe how completely and utterly unimpressed I am with this entirely pointless story. I mean, this is some sort of freak of physical achievement with the vast majority of men wouldn't be able to achieve, and the vast majority of women wouldn't be able to achieve. It's really one of those what's wrong with this story kind of stories. But hey, it's August. We've all been there. I've written my fair share of stories about Afghan female roller skaters and so on and so forth.
Alessio, I sense that Daniela wasn't into that story that much. I don't know why. What do you make of it? This is a good news story, isn't it? Silly season or otherwise.
I think it is a good story, but I fear that anything I'm going to say right now after that very serious moment is going just to collapse. So first of all, except for the fact that one might be daunted to date one of these two girls, because you never know how it ends up being at the end of the evening.
Because of course women always use their physical power to negotiate disputes.
Careful, Leslie.
There you go. You see, I'm walking a very fine line here. I think it's an important element of the story, because it shows that in a context whereby even 10 years ago, people would have been really difficult to open up what is seen as being regarded for a long time a job that had the description that fitted only a small portion of a population of any country is now is being opened up. And we're talking about here one of the most sort of challenging, compelling elements of human sort of commitment to the military.
There you go. Who would have guessed we'd end up by talking about how progressive the US military is by the end of the show? That's all we have time for on today's programme. My thanks to our special guests, Daniela Peled and Alessio Patilano, for joining us on Midori House today. Thanks too to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, and our research team, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Federica Romagnello, and Eugenia Elenskaya, and to our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.